Acts. This week, I can report that there are virtually no dramas. The biggest drama I had was a flat tyre. So no altercations with cars, semi-trailers, any of those things that have been going on. A flat tyre was actually about as exciting as it got this week. So, and we're all still here and we're all still safe and sound. It's absolutely fantastic. You'll probably be aware, those of you who have been around, and if you're here for the first time this morning, you're in for a fantastic morning, but we're right in the middle of a series at the moment that we're calling Confident Families. And the thing that I want to say about confident families is don't just think that family is, you know, that season of life, perhaps when you've got three or four kids and you're trying to make all that happen. As I look around this morning, there would be people that have come from just such a variety of backgrounds. Some of you have had, like myself, I was brought up in a fantastic family, and my parents have done so much for me, and I thank them so much. Others of you will have gone through all sorts of different experiences as part of that. But you know what the exciting thing is that we're all part of the family of God. And you know what the Bible says? It says in Romans 8:14, and I've been reading this verse a lot, it says, "For those who are led by the Spirit are children of God." And it doesn't actually say those that come to church, doesn't say those that pray a lot, it doesn't say those that read their Bible a lot. Those things might be very important, but what it says is being part of the family of God is choosing to be led by the Spirit of God. So whenever you make a decision to get connected with God through Jesus Christ, you are part of the family of God. And I believe that is the basis for any good family. It is the fact that it's part of the family of God. And we're calling this series Confident Families. And this year has been about a confident church. And I believe that confident families really understand that true confidence comes from being part of the family of God. So as we go into Confident Families this morning, why don't you put your hands together? We've got Kevin and Sue Towns. They're going to join me on the couch this morning, and we're going to have a chat about Confident Families. So why don't you welcome Kevin and Sue. So fantastic to have you guys here this morning. And Kevin and Sue, the reason that I've got them here is their parents, and they have four grown-up children. They have three boys and one girl. And so how many grandchildren have you got at the moment?
Is this on? Yes, yeah. It is. We have 10 grandchildren and one to arrive at the end of the month.
Wow.
So that'll be number 11.
11. So it's all still growing and still happening.
Indeed it is.
Yeah, brilliant. So I've certainly been able to, I've known Kevin and Sue for probably, it's a bit scary, about 20 years just about, I think, and they've certainly been parents and have had kids all that time, so, you know, myself and a lot of other people here have been able to watch you guys and in a sense even be part of your family and all the things that are going on. So I thought it was a great opportunity this morning as we talk about confident parenting, to just sort of, you know, get some ideas and some things from you. And I guess there are things that you've said, yeah, that really works in parenting, and gee, if I had my time again, maybe I'd try that different. So we're going to have a chat through some of those things this morning. But, you know, in confidence in anything, it's easy to be confident in something if you've done it before. Like some of the things that I do on a practical level, the crazy things, the water skiing, the motorbikes, the cars, the cycling, all those things. Confidence actually builds the more that you do it. And parenting strikes me as one of those things that suddenly it's there. Like you don't get training, you don't actually, you know, get confidence through that. So let's have a look at maybe the baby years. Sue, what was it like, you know, when all of a sudden you came home from hospital with this, you know, this little life, this little baby, and suddenly having to, you know, to start to work out how that changed your life. Tell us a little bit about that. What struck you first at coming home from hospital with a little child?
Well, I suppose the 9 months of pregnancy is really a time when a woman prepares her mind for that time. So to her, it's just waiting and longing. But I must say, when you've got a new baby, it probably takes you a few months to actually learn to get to know how to be a mum, and to get to know that baby, and to get to work out your own routine. And it is scary, but the wonderful thing about being a new mum is that you do find that women rally around you and help you, and are often your big support.
Yeah, isn't that good? I think I've heard you two say, and correct me if I'm wrong, that at one stage you had three children under five all at once.
Well, Sam was 4 years, 9 months when Michelle was born, so we had four children under the age of five. And the thing I always remembered is that there were always three children in nappies at any one time. So the little baby would be in the real, excuse the word, pooey nappies, and then the next child would be, still trying to potty train, and then another one would be in night nappies, and they weren't disposables. They were the cloth ones that you use nappy sand for and buckets and so unbelievable. Just had the line just full of white, big white cloth nappies. And because the harder, if you didn't put the nappies, what was it, the softening one? Because the pins wouldn't go through.
Yes, we had those big, horrible safety pins as well. Scary stuff.
If you didn't.
So obviously that's a pretty full-on season. And as I see, some of our families here that are in a similar boat, and there's just a lot happening, and probably even as a mum and as a dad, you don't have much spare time. It's it's all there. Can you just, there'll be people that are in that season at the moment, and I look around and I see younger people here that are probably going to be in that season. Can you give us some tips on actually, enjoying that season and being able to do it well? Because obviously it's gone pretty quick, but maybe it doesn't seem like that at the time.
Well, the really special thing about that season is that babies grow so quickly, and when you do have your baby, you feel like it's going to last like this forever, but it doesn't. It certainly doesn't, and you've got to sort of think, well, within a year I've got a little toddler who's maybe walking, so I've got 12 months to have a little baby in the house, and just to enjoy every day with them and not to be impatient, because you do look back and you think, oh, did I really enjoy it? So considering breastfeeding, for example, that is just the biggest delight of a woman's life if she can be successful in that. And so that's just a time full of joy. And I think just to be able to relax in it, to be able to think that every day is so special with this darling little baby, and not to look ahead, not to look at next week or tomorrow, but actually enjoy now and now, because you actually go from one sleep to the next sleep, and you've got to cope within that time, and then you have a rest when the baby's sleeping, and then the baby awakes and you think, this is when you're a brand new mum, you think, how am I going to get the baby to sleep again? It needs to go to sleep. So it's just from sleep to sleep, and you just get through that little time, and gradually through sleep and feeding, the baby just grows.
Fantastic. So you were lucky enough to be a stay-at-home mum, and I know that in this day and age it's not always that feasible to be able to do that. And Kev, for you, you were school teaching through a lot of those years, and very, very busy life. How did you find being able to balance the pressures of work, and I think I know at that time you were taking on new roles and things like that with their own challenges, but also being able to, when you're on at home, to be on and engaged? How did you find the balance of that, Kev?
Oh, you look back and now that we're grandparenting and minding little babies, and Sue's going through it all again with a tiny little baby, and I see her now And she's telling me, the baby's needs are just simply to feed and sleep, feed and sleep, feed and sleep with this tiny little Taj. And I'm kind of looking back and thinking a lot of it's a blur, and how much do I remember? And it amazes me, Sue's memory of those early years. But my memory is having to go to work and coming home, and Sue at times had done it tough that day or tough for that whole week, and feeling a sense of guilt that what can I do to contribute, feeling guilty almost sometimes, having to go off to work and just leave Sue at home with, sometimes without a car, because we had one car, or always without a car actually, and wondering how the groceries got bought, and you know, so you become more and more aware, particularly if you listen to your wife, as to how you can help. And I'm not sure I was as big a help as I should have been or could have been, but what I did do, if I did anything right, and of course, you know, I feel, you know, sometimes guilty being talking about parenting or being up here being interviewed, because it makes us feel like we've done everything right, and of course we haven't. But when I was on, I tried to be on. So when I walked in at 5 o'clock, or with school teaching, you did get in earlier than I would today in business, but you'd be in at 5 o'clock, and I would just really concentrate on that and not go out again until 7:30. So because I later had a job that required after-hours appointments, I'd always say, look, I have an appointment at 6 o'clock, I have another one at 6:30, one at 7, but I'm free at 7:30. And they'd say, but, you know, I want to whatever now. And I'd say, no, I'm free at 7:30. And I knew that the contribution I had to make to Sue was between about 5 and 7:30, which was to play with the kids, to be part of the mealtime. And that was a really, really strict discipline Sue had, is that we all sat down and ate together at 6 o'clock or 5:30, whatever it was, more like 6. And then the news time, putting them to bed, helping change the routine, saying their prayers, tucking them in, and then I was free to study or to make after-hours phone calls or go out on appointments. But I just had to learn that Sue was doing it incredibly tough as a young mum with so many little kids, and the part I had to play was that time and make it good. And then Saturdays and sport and Sundays, just not to go off with the guys, because it was so easy to want the life you used to have where all your mates and you go off and do this and go off and do that. But I very, very quickly had to realise that life was gone for the moment, and to draw a line in the sand, and you couldn't be out with your mates doing this and this and this, and your poor wife's at home with little kids. And it's a real lesson for young dads to realise things have changed and you just can't have the old freedoms you had before. It's family. I don't know if that helps, but
yeah, that's
but it actually does come back to you later.
What comes back?
Freedom, the freedom for fellas and the girls. It does return.
Fantastic. So there you go. If you're in that season, you will get through it and enjoy it. And I really like what you said there, Sue, at probably not complicating things too much, is realising, you know, you're focusing sleep to sleep and almost bringing some of those things back to the basics. You know, the baby needs food, it needs warmth, and just those simple things that we know about.
And the tough thing for the woman, Sue and I discussed this, I don't know, because you may have given up a career for that, you know. You want to get back to work, and there's these pressures on finishing that degree or fulfilling that, you know, you did a teaching degree, you're going through this parenting, and the pressures to go back and quickly get back into teaching are huge, especially with mortgages and finances and financial situations with car mortgages and so on and so on. So Sue and I debated for many, many years as to when she could get back in, you know, and feel fulfilled in the workforce. And that was a struggle. And so we found part-time work was a part answer for that. But there was a season where it just wasn't practical for Sue to be waged and to go and do fulfilling, you know, external things. I don't know what you think about that, love, but...
Yes, it totally wasn't practical. And we did struggle financially, very much so, and we would watch the very last dollar and we would, you know, really watch our budget so, so carefully just to make it through, just to be able to clothe ourselves, even if all our clothes were secondhand, and and, you know, feed ourselves, even if it was boiler chooks and all that sort of thing. So we really, really did struggle financially in those early days when I couldn't contribute. And, we got there.
Yeah, very good. With that season too, I think sometimes those of us that have been like in a church life and a church family and having, you know, ministry responsibilities and things like that, how did you find sort of, you know, balancing some of those things up during that season? Probably for you, Kev, you were still involved with a lot of that sort of thing.
Yeah, look, I don't know that I had the right balance. I'm not, but I just was just so full on in church ministry, if you look at it that way, but life, that I look back almost with embarrassment as to how much I did at the same time. But I guess Sue must have been incredibly supportive, because there wasn't ever a season that we weren't, you know, you weighed, you're coming home with the picture I painted a moment ago. But then, you know, nights and weekends were just full on church work. So I don't know how, I guess it was a lot of grace from Sue that allowed me to do it. I'm not sure it was fair on her, the amount of work I took on with the church, to be honest. But on the other hand, I'm glad I did it. I mean, I struggle when people say, we're having children, we're going to take a season out of ministry. Not that I think that's the correct definition of ministry, because I think it's all ministry.
Yeah, yeah.
Life is entirely ministry, and you've got a ministry to your wife and to your children. That's ministry. So we shouldn't segment it. But I do worry when people say, I'm taking time out, and that just becomes 1 year, 2 years, 10 years, and we never seem to get back to where we left off. So somehow we all have to find a balance in that. Maybe I went too far one way, but through Sue being incredibly gracious, she didn't have to bring in an income, even though we financially struggled. We managed on one income. She made all the clothes. She made all her clothes. Unbelievable, the things you do to get by financially. So people might see us today and see the newer cars and the newer clothing, but we forget, you know, we don't go and see those earlier years. So I cheer on those people that are going through that now, and I think you're doing a fantastic job.
That's good.
But, yeah, look, I look back and maybe I could have been wiser, but I never stopped putting my hand up for roles in the church and so on, and Sue allowed me to do it, I guess.
Yeah, and I think from the woman's perspective, I think the Lord understands. He understands what you're going through. He understands that, you know, for maybe 5-10 years you can't even listen to a sermon. How can you take in a sermon? You've got all these, you know, little children you're dealing with, and at least you try and turn up to church, and that's showing the children that that's part of your routine.
Yeah, good.
Even if you don't take in anything. And the Lord understands that. And, you know, even if you haven't got time during the day to have a quiet time, the Lord understands that. And you may even, silly to get emotional, but you may even just put your head down on the pillow and say amen. That's it. You've had a big day. That's all you can. But you know the Lord's with you. Yeah. You know, how silly am I? You know that you've done your best. Yeah, so it's all good.
Oh, that's great, Sue. And that's really good. God does understand too, and there's no patterns to these things. You can't just do it to a pattern. So very quickly, kids go from that baby stage and all the things that are going on to that, to primary school and starting to become, you know, real little people with their own, you know, own agendas and independence and all the things that happen then. So you know, that primary school season, Kev, tell me some of your memories of that season.
Yeah, you can see reliving this, answering questions, brings it all back, the emotions, and I guess that partly explains why, you know, you go back there. And I could get emotional thinking about the primary school years, but they were great years for me because I was a phys ed teacher back then. They were great years for me because I could buy lots of sports gear, and there would be every piece of sporting equipment you can imagine. So when I'd get home, it would be full on with the footy or the soccer ball or the cricket bat or the tennis, the hockey. It just was full on. And so that was, I felt like I was starting to contribute more in, you know, the passing on the skills of the would-be of the could-be sort of things that Dad thinks about. But then you start to realise these little kids are starting to take you on and they're starting to develop different personalities. And it's probably unfair to talk about the children when they're not here, but we can remember
it's
some...
It's the best time, Keith.
Oh, yeah. We can remember some unbelievable things of knocking on the door by the police and one of our boys had got involved in a rock through a window and a knife and illegal this and that. And we just thought, what have we got? This kid's going to end up in jail, you know. And what have we done? Where have we gone wrong? And this is like in grade five. And I'm not mentioning names, but Joe went through an incredibly rebellious stage. And we just wondered, you know, what have we read here in this kid? You know, he just had an argument on everything, a point of view. He was becoming rebellious. But anyway, I'm probably not answering the question.
All right, how did you... I mean, for the record, Joe hasn't been to jail and, and he's doing really well. But how did you deal with some of those things as, you know, as they happened? Obviously, you got through that and yeah, yeah. He grew up to be a fantastic young man. So what were some of the ways of dealing with it?
I think Sue would answer all of these things better than me. She's the wise one. But look, I remember, oh, man, I was just thinking of Joe drawing that. You come home, how would you be? You come home and you've got a lounge suite, brand new lounge suite you've saved up and you know which kids in the can draw and which can't. So Joe was a brilliant, brilliant drawer. He could draw anything like his Uncle Jeff, just a really, really good artist. And we'd seen him draw cars absolutely perfectly. And you come home and on this lounge suite is this perfectly drawn Land Rover in pen on your new lounge suite. So you call all the kids up and you say, okay, who did it? No, 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 no. No, Joe, did you do it? No. Did you do it, Sam? No, Jake. Michelle, did you do it? Okay, well, I want you to get out a piece, and this is where wisdom comes in. I want you to get out a piece of paper and I all want you to draw a car. So Joe, being a little fella, draws an absolute... I said, you've got to draw a Land Rover. So Joe draws a perfect Land Rover, exactly the same that was on the couch. So I said, well, Joe, obviously you've done it. They match. Anyway, I still haven't answered the question. You've got to try, and think through ways of rewarding honesty. And I guess the discipline and the most harshest discipline came when they told a lie. If they told the truth, it didn't matter how bad it was, if they told the truth, then there weren't going to be the repercussions, of course, than if they told a lie. So, yeah, some of the basic fundamentals of truth and lying and telling the truth, I mean, they're important. Sue might want to talk about some of the discipline she started in primary school. And believe it or not, in primary school, making your bed towards grade five and six, making your own lunch. And so when we started working through, and we'll talk about what happened in grade 7 and 8 and grade 10 later, perhaps, but I know as early as in primary school, there were some disciplines Sue built in. There were jobs I built in, like bringing the wood, and even in primary school, some of those requirements of them to earn pocket money or just be fed.
It's a contribution to the family. That's what it is, to contribute in this family. This is what we do. And so, yeah,
so what are some of the rules you put in early in primary school?
Well, take for example lunches. When you've got four little children and a tiny little kitchen, and you're trying to get lunches, and I was asking, what do you want on your sandwiches? What do you want on your sandwiches? What do you want on your sandwiches? And it wasn't working, so I'd just say, each one, come and spread yourself a sandwich. What do you want? And so they'd spread themselves a sandwich and I'd have the lunch boxes lined up and it ended up that it was like a ballroom in a way. It was like this waltz happening in the morning around the table. They'd all work together and make their own lunch, but they'd all be focused on their lunch box. But the way they would move around and reach over, and it was just like synchronized. Yes, it was just wonderful to watch. But then I wouldn't watch. I'd just go out and let them do it in the end. And so they ended up getting whatever they wanted, making their lunch, and they were responsible for that. And then, of course, you know that they swap lunches at school, so...
And it is amazing.
I did in those days.
What they can in primary school, if you don't start then, it's too late in high school. They are capable of making their bed at an extremely young age. They're capable of doing a whole lot of things like that in primary school before they even get to high school. It's too late to wait then and say, "I'm going to teach you this."
Yeah. So it was mandatory that they made their bed in the morning, but actually, I didn't clean their rooms every week. I'd just do a big clean up. Every holidays, we'd do the toss out, we'd do the clean up, we'd clean things thoroughly, and then I'd try and maintain a level of tidiness, but I wouldn't go in there every... It was just too much to go in there every week, try and sort things out, try and organise things. I just used to say to myself, I'm letting them be kids, you know? They can have the room as they want with a certain level of tidiness. So
yeah,
that wasn't a priority to me.
So it sounds like... through those really formative years, you brought in a sense of we're all contributing to the family and we're all part of this. So, I want to move on in a moment and just start to talk about high school. But is there anything else, Sue? Like Kev just talks about, you know, your wisdom and often bringing it to those times. What would you say to parents that have got, you know, kids in that primary school age group at the moment? What encouragement would you give?
Well, One thing I'd like to say is I think the mother sets the atmosphere of the home. And so if the mother is positive and calm and reassuring, then the home is a calm place. And the other thing I'd like to say is that it's very important that children realise that home is their safe place. So... no matter what they've done at school, at the weekend, any time, then I think it's very important that parents and mothers especially welcome the children home with open arms and never be growling when they walk in the door. So that you give them time to relax at home, and of course if they've been naughty and they have to confess things, they'll be debriefing, how am I going to say this to mum and all this sort of thing. But you give them time and eventually, you know, you can just say to them, tell me about what happened today. And you say that gently and you'll find they'll open up and they'll spill it all out. But to be angry with them when they come home, when they first come home, I believe is not a good thing to do. Always welcome them home. Always... you are. Oh, I'm so glad to see you, you know. Come on in and, you know, welcome them home. Yeah. Really, truly, every time.
Yeah, brilliant. And so very quickly, you've got high school happening and, you know, I can remember growing up myself that I think my mum wondered what happened when all of a sudden we got to that stage. So what did you notice that started to change, you know, in the kids and the way you dealt with them when they started to become young teenagers and at high school?
Yeah, look, the demands on school changed. They started having to already make selections at school. What are you going to be when you grow up? What are you going to do when you leave school? They're coming home and discussing with you, should I take a language or should I take, you know, should I do woodwork, metalwork, in terms of the way it was called back then. And all of a sudden you think, oh, this is all now heading towards something. Homework all of a sudden becomes a factor that was not a factor in primary school. Do you supervise their homework or not? All of a sudden, you sport the expectation they will play a sport and they'll be dropped off. And of course, by then, I'd dropped out of... not dropped out, but I'd resigned from teaching and I was in business. And so I wasn't available on Saturday to take them to sport. And so everything seemed to change when they got to high school. So we had to negotiate our way through that. Encourage them to take selections, choose subjects where they were enjoying them. Sue always had an interesting one on homework. You didn't supervise their homework, did you?
No, I never supervised homework. I never had to tell one child to do their homework. No, I never did. And I cannot understand why. So they were very much motivated to do their own homework for some reason. And they did it. And they really applied themselves. And I would have to tear them away from homework for them to come and eat a meal. And so, yes, they were very motivated. But what I did realise with these jobs we were talking about that we would have to contribute with the family, I remember thinking, there's a lot of pressure on kids to do their homework and all this sort of thing. And I would understand that, and I would help them and let them off jobs if they had a project to do or something to do. And, of course, they were quite young when they were staying up later than me finishing off their homework, and I wasn't monitoring what time they were getting to bed. And the other thing we never had to wake them up in the morning.
I think one of the things that Sue got me onto is that there are consequences. So I guess the overriding philosophy of years 7 to 10 for us was you reap what you sow, the consequences. So if you don't do homework, it's not our responsibility. Whatever happens at school, happens at school. If you're in trouble, you've got to stay back or not. When it came to giving them money, as they got through school and they got later, they were given an allowance and they had to buy all their own school uniforms, their own school clothes. This is in year 9, 10. They're all told, it's grade 7, you get this much. And they got, by the time they got grade 10, they were totally independent financially with all of their clothing, their school lunches or anything. And they had choices and their consequences. So just very quickly, one example, but I mean, there are many examples of this living by consequences philosophy that we had in high school. But one example was one boy went out and spent all of his whole allowance for the whole year, or for the whole term, sorry, was on a jacket. And he bought this trendy jacket. And then he came to his mother and said, I haven't got any socks or jocks. And she said, well, you know, that's your fault. You can go without because you've spent all of your allowance on this jacket. And we told you, thinking about the socks, thinking about your underwear, thinking about this, and this. And so that was might sound an extreme example, but that's the way we did it. So they had in total freedom to make the choice. We would counsel them. We would go with them if they wanted to, but they could do it. And that was not just with money, but it was with a whole lot of things. Sleeping in never woke them up. If you slept in, you were late to school, you live with those consequences. You're free to make that choice to sleep in or not.
Because they did walk to school.
Yeah. Along with that too, I noticed, I can remember watching your kids during that season, and were they responsible for a lot of their own washing and things like that during that season?
Yeah, they were responsible for their own washing. So while they were in their high school years, I taught them how to use the washing machine and wash their own clothes, and it was most amusing what would happen. all their clothes would end up one colour. That was really... But they didn't notice. That didn't worry them at all. And sometimes they'd put a wash through, say, Friday night, and it'd still be in the wash machine Saturday morning, and so I'd just get it out and put it in a basket, and it was still in the basket Sunday night. And there'd be this mad rush thinking, how am I going to dry these clothes? And sometimes they did put them on wet, and it was all just consequences, you know. They were responsible for their own clothes.
They're all given a clothes basket. They're also, there's the washing machine. It was just amazing. But a lot of that was to Sue's credit, never mind.
And for me, it was all because it was too hard for me to keep up with all the washing, you see. And it was just too much. And I was washing all the time and trying to keep, you know, missing socks and things like that. It's just beyond me. So I just handed that responsibility back. Your clothes, you look after them. You know, if you need help, I'll, you know, sew on a button or whatever. Yeah, patch a pair of jeans, but they're your clothes. They're your responsibility.
Very smart. Very clever. That's really good. So how did you find that next season, college, you know, when, you know, the level of independence goes up and different things that years 11 and 12 or college?
One of the things that was always said to us is you wait till it gets worse. You know, you wait till they're teenagers. You wait till they get into uni. I've got to say at the outset, that was never our experience. It always got better. So don't believe that lie that people say, oh, you wait. Wait till you get three kids. You wait till they'll challenge you. That's not the case in our experience. It just gets better and better. And I guess the thing that I'll say at the front end is that I suddenly realised I had to change my approach to my children when they got into years 11, 12, though maybe we're going to go to university or maybe get careers in trades or whatever, that I better quickly start to become their mate and not, you know, the old thing of two bulls in the paddock and headbutting. And, yeah, I was a strong leader in the house and my final say did go and a few things like that, you might think. But really, that was not going to cut the mustard when they started. They could beat me at an Indian arm wrestle or they could put me down if they chose to. I had to quickly realise that how do you become... These kids are going to be able to vote soon. They can go off to war and get shot and die for their country. And they're now 16, 17, they'll be 18 any moment. What's got to change in me? Not them, but me. And I quickly, I don't know where I got it from, but suddenly realised that if I couldn't sit down and have a coffee with them or take and just be a mate to them. And I guess what helped us a little is that every child left home at around 17 years of age, went to Sydney, studied and came home. And I found that when they left, they came back the best friend, a mate, more than... It was more, it's more blurred with Joe. Joe stayed year 11, 12. He did go for a year to Sydney and study. And so he came back and that helped. But he was in our under our roof in all the 4 years of uni. So I guess he'd left. He came back a different person than he left and I was different. But there was every bit of that potential. I would try to be a competition to him in the house again. And I had to be very careful that I didn't do that and give him the freedoms. And all the kids had a key to the front door from about grade 9 or 10 onwards. So, you know, they got a key to the front door. You can come and go. It's your house. You're trusted. Sue had a particular philosophy in those years. When they're out, you tell them, love, about, you know, we could be laying there. It's 11 o'clock at night. Where's Sam? You know, what time is he going to get home? But, you know.
And we had to know where they were going. And we had to know expected time of arrival. And so, but we would leave that up to them and they would get lifts home and things like that. And they always came home and they knew home was a safe place. And you know, I think in those years there are things that your children don't tell you and won't tell you and you don't need to know. And I find, even with now, I'm finding out things that they haven't told me and they're glad they haven't told me and I'm glad they didn't, you know. So, you know, they have their... It's a little bit like they have their own private thoughts and their own private lives, but you've got to trust them in that. And this is where I think it comes into your relationship with the Lord, because... You can only have faith that the angels are caring for them. You can't be with them every moment. You can't police them. You've got to give them freedom. You've got to let them go. And they've got to take risks. And they've got to be allowed to take risks. They've got to be... So you can monitor it to a certain extent, but you've got to really trust the Lord in it, I think. And... you know, it doesn't take long for children to be cleverer than you. And that's a real realisation. As they're growing up and at primary school, it's not long before they can run faster than you. So there's no point in chasing them. And then they get this point where they're cleverer than you. And they know things you don't know. So that's... You've got to give that over to them and have respect for that. And so, and they know what their life is and you've sort of got to let go and realise that you don't need to know everything anymore. But if you have that welcoming heart, when they come in and they've got problems or they want to share things, relationship issues, that sort of thing, if you're just welcoming to them all the time, even at that time, they'll come and, you know, tell you what they need you to know and what they need help with, I feel.
Yeah, brilliant. That sounds like some really wise advice. As we wind this up, and there's so many things we could talk about, but looking at confident parenting, and there's just some thoughts here. Confident parenting shows leadership. I'm going to bullet through some things here, and just for you, Kev, how would you describe leadership in parenting?
I think very quickly, children need to understand that the parents are the head of the home, children flourish when they know boundaries. Very, very quickly, a great research, a famous school had 1,000 kids, had a fence around it. The children went right out to the perimeters of the fence. They played freely. It was a holistic school. Everything looked fine on the fast-forwarded video when they'd show it over weeks. Took away the fence. The children didn't know where the boundaries were anymore, and they all retracted back to the classroom. They weren't free to go out and have their lunch and play and go to the boundaries of the extremities. Amazing research we could talk about in that respect. The home, you've got to have boundaries. The children have to know that their parents are the head of the home. So leadership, I know we could go down a biblical perspective of that I submit to Christ and therefore, you know, there's a sort of if you like, under the headship of Christ, how that all works out theologically perhaps. But the bottom line is the children are not running the home. The parents are. Sue is an amazing leader and is an amazing leader. It just works itself out differently in life, but in the home, Sue is just an amazing leader.
Yep. Next one, and you've answered some of this already, but submission in as far as how does submission work while you're parenting and in the home?
Talking about older children, you can only, as I was saying before, you can only direct them about what happens under your roof. And other than that, they are free to do what they choose to do. They're free to smoke, they're free to drink and all that sort of thing, but you've obviously trained them to say that's not healthy and all that sort of thing, but you can't monitor that when they're out of the home. But when they're in your home, living under your roof, these are the rules and this is what this family does. And I think for mother and father to be agreed at all times, no matter what, on the decisions they make, that is the important thing also. And so the children see the unity and the strength of the bounds between parents, and that gives them so much confidence to know, you know, that the home is their strength and their home is their safe place. And so I think that covers submission.
Yeah, really quickly, we've probably answered some of this, but discipline and bringing about correction.
Sue was brilliant at helping me, saying the consequences to not doing homework. And discipline does change and the definition of it. Maybe more today I would use, the naughty chair or the naughty step or the quiet room. Perhaps if I could do it again more than the smack, there gets a time where the smack doesn't work anymore. So you've got to find ways around that. So they're the hard ones. Do I smack or don't I? Or do I use the naughty chair and so on? So but at the end of the day, they know there are consequences to disobeying. And I think that there has to be boundaries. So you can't just have a child flaunting, your direction and disregarding that without consequences. I don't know that you can ground it. You're grounded, and it can go on and on and on, and you hear amazing kids are grounded for 6 months, 12 years, 12 months, and you're grounded. So it's a struggle. We've got to find our way through that. So, and also different children. I could never discipline Michelle in the way that I did the boys. Mm. So she was just another ball game altogether for me. So I had to submit to Sue's wisdom when it came to correcting Michelle, because I was lost.
But I think the important thing is that you deal with the event quickly and then it's over and you forget about it.
Very good.
And also the follow through. So with little children, I think it's important to say, you know, if you do that again, something's going to happen when we get home. And then if you don't, when you get home, do what you said you're going to do, then they know they can get away with it. But if you deal with it when you get home, remember what happened when we were out? Now we've got to do something about that. They remember that. And so the next time that happens when you're out, you say, if you do that again, there'll be consequences when we get home. You know, they really know you're going to follow through.
Yeah.
And the main thing is to get up, to do it today, get it over with, and then the children are free again. It's don't have discipline issues lingering forever. Yeah. It's just makes childhood awful.
Good. So affirmation, like having an atmosphere of affirmation or love in your home.
Yeah, we've always had our children, the languages of love. Some kids, you know, but there are words and there's touch and there's gifts and there's, all of the different things that are important in parenting. So, Sue, do you want to just add? But I've always had the kids on the knees, always, you know, chewed their ear. whatever, and they just know that. They know that they know. I mean, I don't ever remember my dad saying, I love you. I don't ever remember my dad biting my ear or tickling me, but I just know that I know that I know that deep down he must have.
Yeah.
Because I feel secure in that.
Yeah.
So therefore, I feel free to do it with my kids.
Yeah.
It's just, you know.
And I think if you have any... If you can at any time touch any child anywhere, on their arms, on their face, anywhere, just touch them, keep touching them, put them on your lap, you know, give them a hug, give them a kiss, always touch, touch, touch. That, you know, they're yours if they allow that. So the more you do it, you know, the better it is. So for me, it's always positive words, always positive, never negative, and always... If you've got a reason to touch them, touch them.
Brilliant, brilliant. Why don't you give Kevin and Sue a great big hand? That was absolutely fantastic. Thank you, guys. Did you know what? One of the things that excites me, the band want to join me, please. That would be fantastic. But being in a... We've been talking about family, and we've looked at a particular aspect of family this morning, that parenting part of it, but in a church family, what is exciting is that people are going to go through different stages, different times, and all that. And isn't it great that in a church environment we've got new parents, we've got parents of teenagers, we've got grandparents, and we've just got such a rich resource to draw on. So wherever you're at, please don't think that you're there alone. Make sure you go and talk to some of the grandparents and the other parents and just draw some of their advice when you go through these times. There's a whole lot of other people we could have actually had up here this morning on the couch and given a whole lot of wisdom. So let's make sure we do that. Just as we finish, I want to pray for that gift of parenting. And sometimes it's not always just in the family. I think we've got to be prepared to take on that role wherever we are. I saw something the other week. I saw someone in the church here who's got a particular way that they connect so well with teenagers and just, you know, being able to open up, you know, parts of their life particularly to teenage boys. That's an element of parenting. That's an element of bringing through another generation. So I want to pray for that. I want to pray for that this morning. So maybe there'll be people here this morning, and some of you are thinking, "Gee, how ever am I going to be a parent? Can I do some of those things?" Others of you are, you know, perhaps in that season where it's really hard work. There's a lot going on, but as Sue said, I love what you said, that She said that the Lord, that our God actually understands. He understands where you are at the moment. He understands, perhaps even as I've talked this morning, even as Kevin and Sue have talked, that it's brought up even a little bit of pain for some people. The thing is, God does understand. And He, you know what? He's on your side. He's on your side. And as we've talked about being good parents and being on the side of the kids, the thing is, our Father is on our side. And sometimes we can feel like, oh, we've got to do all these things to prove ourselves, but He is on your side. So I want to pray as we finish this morning. In a minute, I'll give people an opportunity. If you've never been able to experience our God in heaven as a Father, as somebody really close and personal in your life, why don't you come and talk to someone? Why don't you come and talk to me or even Kev or Sue or Pastor Grant or somebody you know and say tell me how I get connected with a God in heaven who wants to love me like a father. And we'd love to share with you how your life can be changed. Your life, you can actually receive a miracle this morning by opening yourself up to Jesus Christ and saying, Jesus, I thank you that you died for me, and I want you to connect me with my Father in heaven. And that is the greatest miracle that can happen. It's the greatest gift that you can give to anybody else, is actually to be connected with your Father in heaven. So just why don't we stand up? And I want to pray. I'm going to pray for those that are yet to be parents. I'm going to pray for those that are parents. I'm going to pray for our grandparents. And I'm going to pray for the rest of us that contribute to the lives of other people, because that's all of us. It's important that we understand that we're family and we understand this whole parenting thing. Lord, I thank you for what's been shared this morning. And I pray right now in Jesus' name. I pray in Jesus' name. I pray for those that are yet to be parents, those that are thinking about it, those that are wondering about all the things that are to come. Lord, I just pray that you would just give them confidence that you will be with them, that you're on their side, that you're going to lead them through that season. And Lord, right now I pray for the parents of our young children, those that are in that incredibly, incredibly busy season of life where it sometimes it just seems so all-consuming. I thank you that you will be their strength, that you will be their guide, that you will be their wisdom, that you are going to lead them through that. Now, I pray for the children in our families. I just pray that our children, the children that you've given to us in this church, and across the greater community where we have influence, Lord, I just pray that we would be good parents, that your love would shine through, that they would experience security, that they would experience confidence because of what actually flows through us, Lord. I pray for our grandparents here this morning. I thank you for the incredible opportunity to be able to come alongside and encourage and just be there and assist. I thank you for our extended family and the fact that we're a family as a church, but also that more than anything else, that we have the incredible opportunity to be part of the family of God. And I thank you that you give us that security in Jesus' mighty name.